Hello and welcome to Pets Plus Us, a weekly program of information and stories about the companions in our lives, our pets. I'm Mary DeFranco, your host for Pets Plus Us. Coming up this half hour, a writer shares a touching tribute to his beloved pet at his passing. And the folks at National Geographic answer lots of weird animal questions. In a previous Pets Plus Us episode, I read a story about one of my favorite writers, Tom Cox, about how he discovered his elderly cat, the Bear, had become deaf. Well, this December, the Bear, at age 21, passed away. Tom posted the news on his blog the next day. It's a touching, albeit very candid, tribute to his furry loved one. It demonstrates the deep and personal bonds so many of us share with our pets and shows how many of us feel when we face losing a beloved pet, how we struggle to prepare for and ultimately deal with the loss, especially when we witness their decline as they age, how we choose to honor their lives and the profound impact they have on ours. Here are excerpts from the piece titled, Goodbye, Kind Friend, Rest in Peace, the Bear, 1995 to 2016. And he writes, my cat, the Bear, died yesterday morning. I'm pretty sure I know the exact moment he died because at about 2:40 a.m. I woke with a full body jolt that felt like a benevolently intended electric shock. And my house felt very different to how it had ever felt before. A few hours later, as the lazy winter sun was finally beginning to rise over the line of bare trees overlooking my house, I went downstairs and found him on his side in the hallway, lifeless. I wrapped him in a towel I'd been recently using to dry him after cleaning his increasingly matted fur, and buried him in the garden. I wanted to dig a grave for him under the yew tree in the spot where he'd loved to sleep for the last three summers, each of which had seemed like a miraculous extension of his long life during his which rain, clear air, and sun seemed to be performing a magic natural spa treatment on his brittle old body. In folklore, yews symbolize longevity and immortality, which would have been perfect for the bear, but the ground was too firm underneath my yew. Instead, I buried the bear on the opposite side of my house near my shed. I dug a hole deep, recalling that badgers had made their sets near here in the past, then remembered that my concerns were unfounded, since prompted by dubious scientific evidence about the spreading of bovine TB, some people have recently shot pretty much all of the ones who used to live around here. I remember writing about the bear, slowing down, and my fears about losing him towards the end of 2012, not long after his 17th birthday. But I was wrong. The bear wasn't slowing down then. When I look at photos of him from that period, and even at those from a year beyond it, what I see is a bright-eyed, if melancholy, cat with a shiny coat who was full of life and who most strangers mistook for an animal half his age. His actual slowing down was more a marked and painful thing to witness, although it was very gradual. First, there was a hollow darkness around the eyes, then an overactive thyroid gland that made it appear that overeating had the reverse effect on him that it has on most animals and people, and after the weight loss came a pronounced arthritic wobble combined with unretractable claws that made it seem that he was tap dancing into any hard-floored room that he entered. He still moved fast at any suggestion of food, exacerbating the campness of the wobble. In summer 2015, I realized his slight deafness had become a greater disability. What made me realize this was the time I was sorting myself some cheese on toast and set my kitchen smoke alarm off, causing my other three cats, Roscoe, Ralph, and Shipley, to scatter, but the bear to merely sit at my feet looking up at me in a way that seemed to say, hello, did someone call? The next bigger stage of the slowing down didn't really occur until the end of this summer, when he lost the ability to groom himself and his arthritis reached another level of severity. Sometimes he'd try to scratch an itch with his back leg but not be able to reach, scratching thin air instead. If I was around, I'd try to find the spot and scratch it for him. I'm not sure that I ever got it quite right. I will try to not write more than is necessary about the bear here. My latest four books, the last ones I will probably ever write directly about him and my other cats, tell the story of his life pretty comprehensively. In order to give the third in the series a boost at a time when I was struggling financially and contemplating giving up journalism, a decision I've made and firmly stood by, I set up a Twitter account for the bear called @MySadCat. Mostly, I felt an enormous amount of love for the bear radiating from my computer. A group of around 24 bright, kind, lovely women who commented regularly on my photos of him and read my books became friends, then started to meet up in person, often supporting each other through tough times and personal crises. They named themselves the Bear's Army and proudly introduced themselves to me as members of it at my spoken word events. Because of this enormous love for the bear, I am nervous that the amount of mourning for him might be unjustly outsized, and perhaps the messages of online sympathy for me. While I am, of course, grateful for the latter, they are unnecessary. I decided to be alone during the final hours of the bear's life and the few hours that followed them, but that was my own choice. I have plenty of friends around me who I know I can look to for support if I need it. I've chatted to several of them, and it's been cathartic and good. As far as the bear is concerned, if he did have the intellectual, empathetic character I ascribe to him, I don't think he'd want you to mourn him. I think he'd want you to celebrate his life, maybe by doing a little something for someone else. Refugees fleeing terrible situations or animals who have not had the luxuries he has had since his awful start in life. I can picture people on social networks linking to this piece without having properly read it and saying, 2016 deals its final callous blow. In that part joking but serious but part joking but actually serious way people do on social networks, but that's not true. This isn't a callous blow. It's just a natural ending to something good that, as endings go, is as about as non-cruel as you could wish for. The bear had an amazingly full and unusually lengthy life, and for the last prolonged chunk of it was clearly very content indeed, which probably explains his fierce will to stay here in the land of the living. I tried to make it even better for him at the end, if that was possible. I feel certain that at my local village shop, I am known as the guy who buys all the chicken. They would probably never guess that I am a vegetarian. Cats are supposed to have 9 lives. The bear undoubtedly went through far more. A few weeks before his death, around the time of his 21st birthday, when he became old enough to drink in America, but disappointingly unable to take advantage of that fact due to never leaving my garden, I made a list of the lives I could think of, which, of course, were only the ones I knew about, and not the others, which were no doubt numerous. The time he was dumped on the hard shoulder of a motorway by his original owner, the time most of his fur fell out because he was allergic to fleas, the time most of his fur fell out again because he was allergic to the treatment for the fleas, the time he escaped from my old flat in London and was away for over a month and came back smelling of death and cabbage, the time he got carbon monoxide poisoning, the time my other more thuggish black cat, Shipley, shut the lid on the cardboard box he was asleep in, then jumped on the cardboard box, the time feral cats ripped a hole in his throat, then made rips in his ears so they looked like they had been clipped by a ticket inspector on a train, the time he developed asthma due to the hole in his throat, the time my old next-door neighbor's elderly cat, Biscuit, broke his heart by refusing his gentle advances, the time he somehow ended up on the opposite side of the river to my old house even though there wasn't a bridge, the time he developed an overactive thyroid gland, the time he fell in my garden pond, the time he almost died from an abscess on his eardrum, and the time after that when he was diagnosed with cancer, which then vanished. I really thought 13 and 14 at the start of September this year would signal the end for the bear and had prepared myself for that. Earlier in the summer, when he'd started to look more visibly elderly, I stopped putting new photographs of him online. He was a dignified cat, and I wanted to preserve that dignity by not publicly charting his decline. When the eardrops and antibiotics I gave him cured his abscess, and miraculously, the symptoms associated with the suspected tumor between his eye and jaw dissipated, I officially retired the bear from the internet. People still ask me every day if they could see the bear, but in all honesty, I'd already gone on tweeting from his account for longer than I felt comfortable with. After that, the bear had two very good months. Despite his wobblier and wobblier legs, he still jumped on the coffee table and my bed. He still enjoyed being outside in the strong Devonshire sun and appeared to gain strength from it. But when he took a turn for the worse a couple weeks ago, I was aware there would not be yet another miracle turnaround. He could not go on forever, despite multifarious previous signs to the contrary. At the start of this week, I knew he was declining in a more significant way, and I suddenly became acutely conscious of the shining fur and muscularity of my three other cats, two of whom are 15 and a half themselves. It began to hit me how much time I'd started to spend looking after him, cleaning him, and cleaning up after him. I thought about other elderly cats not lucky enough to have homes, and decided to give my earnings for copies of my book sold this week to my local rescue center in the form of food. Immediately after his death, I took the proceeds of this plus a bit extra to the animals in distress shelter in the South Devon village of Ipplepen. The shelter thanked me, but I felt wrong for taking the credit. They should have been thanking the bear. It was his idea. Right now, I'm struggling with a few of the standard feelings that come with the death of a beloved pet or person. An emptiness in the house where a small, comical, and lovable, and apparently deeply thoughtful presence once was. There is part of me that feels that by burying him only mere hours after I was stroking him in his favorite spot on his chest and making him purr, I have in some way thrown the bear away, even though I know it's wildly irrational. I don't believe such feelings are untypical. Neither probably is the way my mind tends to dwell on my final images of him. I think, in fact, this is perhaps an important part of acknowledging what has happened. Overall, I'm doing okay, and mixed into the ache in my chest, there is a feeling that, above all, there is something to be celebrated here. A longevity so extreme and death-defying, it made you laugh. A unique character and an end that could have been far worse. Many would argue that kindness isn't in a cat's nature, but if there was ever such a thing as a kind cat, it was the bear. To my knowledge, he never killed or even attacked another living being. When other cats and, on the odd occasion, seagulls appeared keener for food than him, he willingly moved aside. When I was poorly or sad, and I know this is less unusual in a cat, he seemed to know and moved in closer. Friends who came to my house initially fell in love with Roscoe, Ralph, and Shipley for more obvious reasons, but left besotted with the bear, enchanted by a polite, curious, almost philanthropic look in his saucer eyes. After seeing the state he was in on the night before his death, I had steeled myself and decided that the next morning I would take him to the vet to be put to sleep. That is what would be the best course of action for him, the only course of action. But I utterly, utterly dreaded it. That he saved me, that agonizing experience could be viewed as his final act of kindness, a last quiet gesture from one of the cat universe's gentler souls. It was from Tom Cox on the passing of his 21-year-old, the bear. So let's lighten things up. Weird animal questions from Liz Langley at National Geographic. We will start with, surprisingly enough, why cats poop on your bed and other odd pet behaviors. She writes, when Hillary's brown cat Wasabi left a holiday gift that looked a lot like a lump of coal on her bed, we figured that was one mad kitty. But was it? Weird animal questions. Experts asked, what are some of our pets' behaviors we completely misread? The first one is midden meanings. Yes, midden. Cats mark their territories by leaving various scents, often via defecation, a phenomenon called middening, says Nick Dodman, author of Pets on the Couch, Neurotic Dogs, Compulsive Cats, Anxious Birds, and The New Science of Animal Psychiatry. So Wasabi's pooping in the bed wasn't an angry statement. More likely, he was anxious because Brown had recently been traveling, Dodman says. Wasabi went to where his owner's scent is strong and left his feces, a gesture that essentially says, I want to be close to her, but physically I can't be, so let's just combine smells, Dodman says. Pooping in a place other than the litter box may also be a cat's way of reclaiming its territory after a house guest has visited, he adds. Even so, cats don't necessarily need to feel anxious to mark their territory. Dodson explains, Wasabi, for instance, poops in the bed on normal days, too. Watch the birdie. Cats aren't the only ones that leave homemade gifts. Many pet birds perform a behavior that looks like they are throwing up on their owners. Zach Olson, Animal Behaviors at the University of England, says via email, it's not showing their distaste. Birds regularly vomit food to feed their chicks and flirt with suitors. So regurgitation is a sign of affection, Olson says. Playing possum. Rabbits are prey animals, and they don't forget that, even when in the comfort of our homes. The animals get alarmed pretty easily by situations such as smelling a cat or dog being taken to the vet or, in some cases, being handled. In these cases, they may freeze, a posture mistaken for relaxation when really the animal is terrified, Olson says. Much like an opossum playing dead will avoid predation, rabbits go limp, hoping the danger will pass. This behavior is seen when a rabbit is being bathed, which rabbits generally find terrifying. The limpness is mistaken for relaxation when the rabbit is actually quite stressed out by the experience. Cheese. We've seen a zillion smiling dogs on the internet, but what do they really mean? Canines with lips raised vertically is an aggressive sign, Dodman says. On the other hand, if the lips are retracted horizontally, it's a submissive sign, an expression owners may inadvertently train their dogs to do. Since this doggy grin looks so cute, the owner pets and praises the animal whenever it happens, which makes them do it more. Sloppy kisses. Licking is often mistaken for dogs wanting your body salts, but it has multiple meanings, Dodman says. When dogs sniff things, they'll also lick them, which brings the chemicals in the object toward an organ inside their mouth called the vomeral nasal organ. This nose within the nose, just behind its front teeth, allows dogs to get a better read on what they've encountered. So a dog's sloppy licking could be just a way of figuring you out. Licking can also signal submission or a gesture of kindness, which dog owners often call a kiss. Though dogs don't really kiss, Dodman says. You never see two dogs with their lips pressed together in the moonlight, he quips. More weird animal questions. The truth about cats. It's official, cats are mysterious. Liz Langley writes that she got a cascade of questions from curious cat people, proving that even their owners can't fathom them. Why do all my cats like the smell of my stinky shoes? One asks. They can't seem to get enough. In nature, scents are messages, so in general, animals tend to be attracted to smelly surfaces, said Carlo Siracusa, a veterinarian at Penn Vets Ryan Hospital in Philadelphia. Smelly shoes are likely to come with odors, including pheromones, from other cats or animals. when a cat rubs on smelly shoes, he probably wants to rewrite the message on the shoes, adding his signature. He may also want to exchange signals with the owner who is a member of the same social group. Another question, can an FIV-positive cat, one with feline immunodeficiency virus, live happy and healthily with a non-FIV-positive cat? Julie Callen Clark, also of PenVet, said it depends on the relationship of the cats. The virus, which lives only a short time outside the body, can't be transmitted by sharing water bowls or by mutual grooming, and is primarily transmitted by biting. Therefore, if the cats know each other and have no aggressive tendencies toward one another, they could exist happily, Clark said, though a cat fight could transmit the disease. Clark noted that transmission of FIV in multi-cat households is considered to be an infrequent event. And will clipping a cat's claws make them not scratch things as much? Dr. Syracusa says scratching is a complex behavior, which serves many functions, such as keeping the nails sharp and functional and communicating with other cats. And Barbara Sherman of North Carolina State's College of Veterinary Medicine in Raleigh added that even declawed cats will scratch, and that this characteristic behavior may have to do with stretching and conditioning their limbs. It's usually done after a nap. So often we try to put a scratching post for a cat near their resting site, she said. She encourages owners of indoor cats to trim their pets' nails, which they can learn to do with the help of a vet and a few treats. This can minimize damage to the home and injuries to the cat, as well as avoid the surgical procedure of declawing, which provides no medical benefit to the animal, according to the Humane Society of the United States. And how can I stop one cat from clawing my door sills and the other from urinating in the bathtub and sink and on floor mats? Sherman said this doorbell scratcher has made a personal choice. Cats have a need to scratch and stretch, and there's just something about this surface the cat likes, she said. In order to save your sills, provide the cat with an alternative, like a scratching post, that she will like and use. It might take a few tries. Once that need is met, then cover the door sills with double-sided sticky tape or a similar product. We've got to barter with the cat to say, we don't want you to use the sills anymore, but we want to give you what you need, Sherman says. The cat that urinates outside the litter box may have an underlying medical problem, she said. Cats prefer a loose, absorbent surface as a latrine. If urination is painful, the cat might associate the litter box with that pain and may go to a place that's very different and try it and see if it's less painful. Lastly, owners shouldn't yell at or punish a cat for either behavior, Sherman said, especially for urination. Cats may just be trying to communicate something to you, so you have to learn how to listen. And how cats and people grew to love each other. This was posted by Stefan Suracek in National Geographic's Cat Watch. Long before cats ruled the internet and tamed humans to do their bidding, they had to be domesticated themselves. But the science has always been murky on when that occurred. Today's domestic cats are believed to be the descendants of ancient Near Eastern wildcats and the previous discovery of a wildcat buried near a human in Cyprus roughly 9,500 years ago suggests some type of long-running relationship. The Egyptians famously thought very highly of cats, keeping them domestically and even administering medical treatment to them some 4,000 years ago. Now, in a new study marks possibly the earliest known evidence of a beneficial relationship between humans and cats. Researchers analyzing 5,300-year-old cat bones found at the village of Quanqin in China determined that the bones match up closely with those of modern domestic cats, and that people may even have fed the animals. Cats followed rats to domestication. In the Yangshou period in China, farmers in the village of Quanqin grew millet crops, and kept domesticated pigs and dogs. This agricultural activity attracted rodents, which in turn may have attracted wildcats. At the archaeological site, scientists uncovered ancient rodent burrows leading to grain storage pits. They also found ceramic vessels whose features suggest they were designed to keep rodents from pillaging food stores. This means there was plenty of pest control work for cats to do and plenty of incentive for people to encourage them to move in. The ancient cat's diet provided researchers with further clues about their relationship with people. Chemical analysis of the bones showed that one cat had eaten a largely plant-based diet, in other words, human-grown grain, while another had lived to an advanced age. These results suggest that cats may have played a variety of roles in the settlement, ranging from mutualistic hunters and scavengers to encouraged animals or even pets. According to the study published this week in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the benefit would have been mutual. Villagers got a live-in rodent exterminator to protect their grain, while wildcats got a year-round supply of food and presumably a steady supply of warm laps. In other words, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. More weird animal questions. Is your dog part coyote? We're going right to the dogs to answer your inquiries about our wild and wonderful world. The first question is, I have read about Kai dogs, and I'm very curious to find out if our dog is one. I cannot find a DNA test available to determine this. And the answer? Kai dogs and Kai wolves. Coyote dog and coyote wolf hybrids occur in the wild in the United States. For instance, coyotes in the northeastern U.S. carry DNA from both wolves and from domestic dogs, albeit in small amounts, according to a 2011 study. Most commercially available canine DNA tests don't identify coyote DNA, but Terry Kuhn, a forensic scientist at the University of California Genetics Lab, says dog owners can get a DNA test to determine their dog's coyote heritage via her lab. And you can visit that website at vgl.ucdavis.edu for more information. And that will do it for this week. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. I want to wish you and your loved ones, human and non-human, a very happy new year filled with peace and love. Pets Plus Us is a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. If you'd like more information about this program or to hear this program again, visit our website at wxxi.org/reachout. I'd also like to invite you to share your pet story with us by writing to us at reachout@wxxi.org.